after blessing, when he was just Ezekiel, my brother and my sworn lord, not war master Abaddon, chosen of the gods. In time I would scarcely be able to stand near him, forever bathed as he was in a rippling, replenishing saturation of soul matter, with the warp itself forming a choir heralding his every move. He could not growl without even his closest warriors edging away, nor nod without thousands of demons shrieking in acclamation. But not yet. I could see the silhouettes of unborn demons seeking birth through his aura, feeding on his hatreds, and I could see the way the warp focused upon him as though he were a nexus. But such things happen to many souls of significance inside the eye. I did not know then that I was witnessing a mere fraction of his future majesty. As we jeweled, two other presences joined us. The first was Nefertari, whom I sensed watching us from where she sat among the arching rafters. She should not have been here, but beyond a curl of Abaddon's lip, as he too sensed the alien, he gave no further reaction. The second was Nagual, who melted out of the shadows and watched the fight with burning white eyes.
"Master," he greeted me.
I could do little more than pulse back brief acknowledgement. Sweat rimed my face. My vision danced with smears of afterlight, blurring with the lightning cracks of the two meeting blades.
"Nagual,"
Abaddon greeted my lynx, his breathing ragged with the effort of our battle. The lynx yawned in answer.
"You should not be here, Nagual," I sent.
"The cold huntress is here."
Abaddon sensed my distraction, and thrust low. I barely weaved aside, hammering the flat of my blade against his, deflecting it at the last moment.
"She is,"
I admitted, "but Nefertari at least has the presence of mind to stay out of sight." Abaddon fought with the talon held back and low the whole time, knowing it had no place in a spar, knowing also that, coming too close to the weapon, savaged my psychic sense with its bloodied resonance. As much as I had adapted to weather the pressure of its closeness over the years, if I narrowed my eyes I could still see the mist of death echoes that surrounded its curving claws. That haze of psychic potency attracted countless unformed demon things. These too I could see if I focused. They prayed to the weapon. They whispered lovingly to it, an inhuman murmur of praise for all that it was capable of doing in changing the paths of the future. They sang their shrieking, howling songs in gratitude for all that it had done in writing the pathways of the past. In so many ways, as fascinating and disgusting as it was, the Talon was a taste of what would come when Abaddon claimed Drak'nyen. Despite my distractions, I was winning. Having to keep the Talon back and low affected his balance, even though his Terminator warplate enhanced his physicality far beyond mine. I had to hold Sacramentum in two hands, for it was the only way to meet the heavy blows powered by his bulky armor.
"Morianna,"
he said, when our blades rasped apart, both swords raining sparks across the deck.
"You don't trust her."
"I do not trust any seer," I pointed out.
"No?"
He backed away, his blade rising on guard.
"You trust Ashokai?"
That was debatable. I certainly had no faith in his prophecies, for I had no faith in any prophecy. But I refused to be drawn into that discussion. I knew why he had detained me here, and it had nothing to do with Morianna.
"You should have killed Daravek,"
he said in the face of my silence. Oh, yes, here it was. Punishment at last. I had never deluded myself into hoping that the trivial task of journeying to Malium to examine telemetry fluctuation might serve as my only chastisement. Returning with evidence of the Black Templar's existence, and even bringing Morianna into our coven, was never going to earn forgiveness for my other failures. I wondered very briefly if he was going to kill me. For a couple of heartbeats, when our blades whined and crashed, it seemed plausible. Would he do it, if Morianna had told him it was necessary to secure her nebulous future? I did not know. And did I lean a little more strength into my blows when he reminded me that Daravek still lived? Perhaps. Perhaps I did. I said nothing, though. There was nothing to say. I would not deny my failure, nor make excuses for it.
"A target you cannot kill, Kaon,"
He was defending with more ragged deflections, unable to match my speed.
"Is this fated to become a frequent occurrence? Do I need a new assassin? Should I send one of the others when next I need someone slain? Telemachon?"
My jaw ached with my clenched teeth. From far above I heard Nefertari's soft laugh. The next three blows that rained against Abaddon's blade sprayed flare sparks into both of our faces. Still, I said nothing.
"You heard how Moriana speaks of Daravik?"
Abaddon continued, grunting the words now, his own temper rising in mirror of mine.
"Whispers of destined threat and obstacles of fate?"
"Her words are meaningless," I lashed back with an overhead cut, two-handed and descending. He took it flush on the blade. I heard the servos in his shoulder and elbow snarl at the pressure of holding me back. Abaddon laughed as I disengaged, though he blocked the following blows as well, hurling me back each time with a toothy smile.
"I have wanted Daravek dead for decades, Iskandar. Yet still he lives. I have set my precious weapon against his throat 5 times, and yet still he draws breath."
I am not without pride. No warrior is. I could accept my failure and bear the shame, but his mockery boiled my blood. I met the anger in his eyes with my own. Our blows were beginning to feel less like the strikes of a spar. They swung harder, they landed heavier. The talon flashed at Abaddon's side, twitching. His voice was rising.
"Daravek unites dozens of warbands against us,"
Abaddon pressed.
"He deadlocks our fleets. He laughs at us, pissing on what we're trying to build. And still he lives. Why is that?"
He was giving up ground, backing away slowly, parrying and deflecting without fighting back. I had him now. I could read the hesitancies in his movements that spoke of an inability to keep pace. Yet he laughed all the while, an angry and baiting laugh, meeting my eyes to share his bleak amusement at my failure. He was sincere. That was what ground my teeth together and stole the words from my tongue. This was no jest, no mockery for the sake of spite. He was sincere. Laughing at me, yet furious. Moriana's promises of Daravek's ascension had added graver consequences to my inability to carry out Abaddon's orders. The talon crashed Sacramentum aside, and Abaddon dropped his blade in the same smooth motion, pounding his free hand against my throat, wrapping around and lifting me with hydraulic growls of Terminator joints. My boots left the deck. I could not draw breath. And though a legionary can survive many minutes without oxygen, as I looked into Abaddon's wrath-rich eyes, I doubted it would be asphyxiation that killed me.
"Is it you that is broken?"
The words were a beast's rumbling growl, saliva bow-stringed between his teeth.
"Master,"
Nagual sent from nearby. I did not move. To move would be to provoke Abaddon's rage, furthering its downward spiral. I knew these rages, and I knew they were earned more often than not.
"Stay back, my master.
Stay back, Nagual."
A breath of wind and a silken purr of alien technology heralded Nefertari's descent. Abaddon spoke to the shadows, though his eyes never left mine.
"Alien? Beast? If either of you take a single step closer, this turns from punishment to execution."
The ceramite of his gauntlet closed tighter around my throat.
My spine clicked and crackled. My jawbone pulsed with pain in time to my twin hearts. "You are broken, Kahan."
Abaddon dropped me. My boots thudded to the deck.
"Broken,"
he continued,
"but not irrevocably."
I drew a slow breath through my constricted throat, watching him closely. My voice would not come.
"Broken?"
I asked, mind to mind.
"You no longer hate, Kahan. You have come to accept this exile inside the Eye. You no longer seethe with the need to revenge yourself on the Imperium for the wrongs done to us. You say you no longer dream of wolves, and you shine with pride over it, as though it were a failing at last overcome."
Abaddon shook his head, his golden eyes glittering with unspoken insights.
"Hate is valuable. It made you a killer. Hatred sustains us. Hatred is all we have. Vindicta, my brother. Vengeance, our fuel, our sustenance. Where is your passion to prosecute this war? Hmm? Where is your need to see the wolves of Fenris bleed for what they've done to you, for the life they stole from you? Where is your rage at the Emperor for censuring your legion and forbidding the very gifts that set the Thousand Sons apart?
I knew rage at Horus Lupercal, for deceiving the wolves into destroying my homeworld. Rage at the wolves themselves for their frothing, idiotic zeal and their ignorant beliefs. Rage at Magnus the Red for offering us up on the altar of his martyrdom and failing to defend Tisca at our side. But anger at the Emperor? One may as well hate the sun or the laws of physics. I said this to Abaddon, who shocked me by laughing.
Look at the mastery you and your sorcerous brethren hold over the warp now. You are no longer librarians questing blindly in the dark. You face the dangers, meeting them with open eyes. You are aware of the predators that swim in this infinite murk. Was the Emperor right to order you to remain ignorant?
I could not answer that last question. In my hypocritical heart, I feared to give a response. The more I learned of the warp, the more the Emperor's mandate made sense. I could not pass the opportunity for power now, not when those around me showed no such restraint, but I could see why the Emperor had commanded us to do so. The more familiar I became with the realm behind the veil, the more I mourned that the Thousand Sons in our blind arrogance had believed we knew everything worth knowing. We had stared at the sky and believed we knew everything of the stars. We had looked at the ocean's calm surface and believed there was nothing deeper beneath. Abaddon saw my hesitation. He smiled without surprise.
"Do you see?"
he asked me.
"Do you see what you've become? Moriana brings word of a weapon we might use. And rather than peer into the warp for ways to master it, you doubt that it can be wielded at all. Rather than devote yourself to slaughtering the one foe you failed to kill, you slink around the flagship, accusing, hesitating, holding back." He slammed a palm down on my shoulder, a brotherly grip, his golden eyes boring into mine.
"Rediscover your hate, Kaon.
It began to fade when you hunted Daravek that first time, and it has depleted in increments ever since.
I need you. My brother. My blade. Reforge yourself, for if we accept the Eye as our domain, we have already lost. It makes us nothing but broken weapons. This is a prison and a lair to lick our wounds, not our home, not our fate."
I nodded, for agreement was the only reaction I could offer. I have torn souls open before, reading mind and memory, peeling back the layers of personality and flaying a man's essence to rifle through the heart of his being. Such torment left the victims of my interrogations nothing more than fractured husks. Abaddon's words had threatened to unmake me in the same way. So precise were his insights.
"It will be as you say, brother," I said.
Abaddon lifted his hand from my armor.
"We stand on the edge of returning to the Imperium we built with our own sweat and sacrifice. Tagus Daravek will come for us before the end. I need him dead, Iskandar. No more excuses. I need him dead."
I knew he asked the impossible of me. And may I be damned for lying to my brother, but I nodded my avowal. I agreed to do something I was sure I could not. He turned and left me there, in that museum of futile wars, and with Moriana's destiny-soaked venom turned to honey in Abaddon's ears, we sailed for the edge of the Great Eye. Part 2. The Edge of Hell. The ferryman demanded we pay the price of freedom. We paid as everyone must pay, in coin of flesh, of soul, of blood, of life. We paid, we gambled, our future. But it must be this way. Sacrifices must matter, don't you see? A sacrifice is only true if it drains the giver and nourishes the taker. So we gave, and the ferryman took, and we were lessened, and they were enriched. From the Infinity Canticle, sequestered by the holy order of His Imperial Majesty's Inquisition as an ultima-grade moral threat, purported to be the unedited raving confession of Sargon Eregesh, Lord Prelate of the Black Legion. Chapter 8. Outrunning the Storm. The first ship to die was the Inviolate. It was a Terran-born destroyer, one of the oldest vessels in our fleet, and one of the most reliable. It had sailed the skies in the very earliest years of the Great Crusade, and though it was originally sworn to the Seventh Legion, the Sons of Horus had wrested it from the Imperial Fist's masters during the Siege of Terra. Its current captain, the former Sons of Horus Reaver chieftain, Zerakan Kovis, was a calm and calculating officer with a gift for void battle. The Inviolate itself was a beautiful vessel, a spearpoint cutter of a warship, swift and lethal. It exploded after 11 minutes and 9 seconds of redlining instruments and warning klaxons, the stress upon its hull too much to bear. I watched it happen. I listened to the final calls of its command crew, laced with interference across the fleet-wide vox. The Inviolate buckled off course, falling out of alignment with the fleet, tumbling into the seething tides of fiery warp energy that thrashed and boiled around our armada. I saw it enveloped in those dissolving waves, its shields bursting as it plunged into them. I saw the ship's hull first crumple, crushed by the grip of impossible pressures, then come apart, pulled open as though it were nothing more than a child's toy. I felt the Inviolate's sorcerer pilot's final thoughts, the split-second desperation of, "Wait! Wait!" that he unintentionally breathed into the burning night. I felt no fear from him. Perhaps he believed he could still maintain control in that flash-fire second before he was bathed in the cascading energies of unreality. And whatever the truth, the mundanity of the sentiment was a breed of madness in its own right. The refusal of consciousness to realize its end has come. Rarely do we sound so human, but death perhaps is the great equalizer.
"The Inviolate has fallen,"
Ultio called out across the bridge. Her voice betrayed her distraction as she faced forwards, floating in her immense life-support tank. Her crown of cognitive interface tendrils swayed in the fluid between the young woman and the hive of gestalt brain engines fixed to the chamber's ceiling above her. Her eyes were narrowed to slits, her teeth clenched, her outreaching hands curled into claws of effort. She wore an expression she had never worn in life, a rictus of such inhuman ferocity that it momentarily drew my eyes away from the oculus. Blood was beginning to stain the fluid close to her body, curling into the aqua vitriolo in misty, sanguine threads from cuts appearing across her flesh. Around her, around all of us, the bridge was a red-stained place of fear scent and thunder. Abaddon clutched the handrail at the edge of his raised dais, his golden gaze locked to the storm, kaleidoscoping outside the ship. The vengeful spirit juddered in its entirety. We heard its central spinal stanchions growl, then whine in the storm's grip. At the bridge's heart, the anamnesis cried out in sympathetic pain. The din of the vox rivaled the tempest tearing us apart. The voices of every captain in the fleet cried out in disordered unity, reporting their progress and roaring of stress fractures, of failing shields, of shipboard fires and uncountable deaths. I could hear space around us, the void itself shrieking with the outpouring of souls dragged from dying bodies. Our fleet was populating the warp with the spirits of our slain. We led the way. The vengeful spirit took the brunt of the tempest's tide, a wave-breaker vanguard that ploughed through the roughest thrashings of energy, shattering them to carve a route through for the smaller ships. New trails of blood inked the amniotic fluid from a fresh latticework of wounds across Ultio's body. she suffered as the ship suffered. The promise of absolution was a jagged silhouette off our port bow, another of the forward battleships spearing ahead to take the worst of the boiling tides. One moment it was there, shaking and streaming fire from its battlemented hull. The next it was a lacerated hulk, killed too swiftly to even detonate. Torn apart sections of the ship tumbled away into the warp's devouring essence. It was as if the entire ship had crumbled as part of an avalanche. We did not even hear any change in their final communications. One moment the captain was there, the next his voice was no longer present in the Voxweb. Delvaris was next to me, his boots magnetically locked to the deck, his gauntleted hands holding to the same crew rail as mine. He was second-born, the melange of demonic entity and human soul, and as ever in his presence I felt the war taking place inside him, the eternal shifting turmoil between possessor and possessed. His eyes were blackened orbs in his dark flesh, curdled over with etheric cataracts, and though the warp had rendered him blind, it had suffused his other senses with sensitivity beyond measure. When the promise of absolution died, his face twitched as if in pain, though I knew it was far more likely hunger.
Was that the absolution?
His voice was a raised snarl. I could feel the need within him, the feverish desire to adopt what he and his brethren called the war shape, letting the demon, threaded through his flesh, ascend to the fore in the hour of bloodshed. He fought the instinct, just as he fought the bite of the butcher's nails in his brain. It was, I sent back, telepathy far more reliable than shouting amid so many other voices. He twitched again, this time in true pain, at his cranial implants reacting to the unwanted touch of my silent voice.
There were almost 2,000 warriors on that ship,
he said between clenched teeth. He didn't mention the tens of thousands of slaves, serfs, thralls, and servitors. But even noting the loss of our brethren was a sentiment I had never expected from Delvaris, of all men. He said more, but the vengeful spirit kicked around us as it pounded through another devastating wave, casting the deck into flickering darkness for several seconds and intensifying the warning sirens. Ultio screamed again, her voice razoring from the shouting mouths of 100 gargoyles and fallen angels. The ship cried out with her, from its ram to its roaring engines, its superstructure groaning with torment. As that jewel cry rang through our minds, I looked up to Ashokai. He stood on his navigational platform above the bridge, eyes wide, long hair like a banner in the grip of a storm's wind. He was braced, as we were all braced, though he saw none of us. His sight was tuned to the realm outside the ship, and his hands on the twin control columns sent impulses and commands to Ultio and to the vengeful spirit itself. I'd never seen Ashokai and the Anamnesis move in such perfect synchronicity, their motions mirrored, each lean and tilt and adjustment coming in the very same second for both sorcerer and living machine spirit. Even their injuries were in sympathy. The psi stigmata that decorated Ultio's flesh showed across Ashokai's face in the same constellations of ripping pain. Three of those slashes tore open to the bone. Only when the ship crashed through the most forceful tides did they fall out of alignment, and Ashokai's pale features would strain with the effort of finding that slipped harmony once more. The vengeful spirit was Ultio's ship. Thanks to the Mechanicum's ingenuity, she was far more aware and attuned to her vessel than most machine spirits could ever be. But it was Ashokai, her void guide, who saw the way through the storm. If there was a way through this one.
I do not believe there is.
Evidently he had heard my careless thoughts. The next ship to die was one of the nameless bulk cruisers that carried clans of beastmen warriors and warp-changed human slave soldiers. Its death lit the oculus as it veered wildly off course, rolling into the acidic tides either side of the turbulent channel we were carving, and a migraine crack of light flared sun-bright for half a heartbeat. A fraction of a moment later it was gone. All that remained were the echoes of its captain's screams over the Voxweb. Three of Ultio's vox gargoyles toppled from the gothic rafters and shattered into marble rubble across the deck. Another, one of the bronze sculptures, with its features twisted in ecstatic agony, crashed onto one of the crew consoles with the sound of a great bell tolling, killing two humans and crippling a third. I made my way to Abaddon, forced to move as a drunkard might across the shaking bridge and staggering over the corpses of the storm slain. I gripped his shoulder guard, forcing him to face me. His face was his father's face, red-lit by the emergency illumination, flashing with the colours of madness that danced outside the dying ship. "We will not survive this," I sent directly into his mind. "The spirit cannot endure this punishment. We must break through," he spat back through his filed teeth. "We will break through!" And then, with the ever-surprising force of his own will, he spoke right into my mind. "I will not die in this prison, Iskandar. I will be free. We will all be free. We will bring our fury to the Golden Throne itself, and the husk enshrined there will weep with the homecoming of his abandoned angels." I met his eyes for what felt like an eternity, though I know it cannot have been more than a brief moment. Blood of the Pantheon, but he looked like his father then. The creature before me was Horus, in body and blood. The only difference was the eyes. Horus had been hollowed through by the powers he had sought and failed to control. Abaddon was drained by forever resisting them. The father had been but a host for the strength of others. The son was a bastion of his own will and endurance. I saw then, truly and for the very first time, just what value my lord could be to the creatures we call gods. "What do you see, Iskandar?" I snapped back to the reality of our flagship burning, shattering around us. "What?" "Outside the ship. Do you see their hands at work?" Abaddon knew none of my internal revelations. He wanted me to spread my senses beyond the warship's hull. Were we being held here? Was this hurricane the whim of the malevolent consciousnesses that acted through the galactic wound we called the Eye? I cast my perceptions wide, breaking through the walls of the vengeful spirit, plunging into the firestorm of warp energy. I felt the cataclysm of forces at work, the shoving rage of our engines generating an equal pushback in the Eye's resistant tides. I saw our armada drifting apart, unable to hold cohesion in the chaos. I saw demons, a billion demons, a trillion demons, riding and leaping and melting out of the warp matter to burst, laughing, howling, clawing against our warship's hulls.
"Iskandar!"
I opened my eyes to my lord's face once more. Sparks sprayed elsewhere across the command deck. I could smell burning fur and sizzling blood. Beastmen cawed and croaked and brayed and bellowed and died. So many of them were dying.
"Stop the ship!" I said.
And though there was no hope of hearing me over the thunder, Abaddon read my lips.
"Is it them?"
he sent into my mind, fierce as a lance through the skull. I tensed and sought to back away from him, but he held me in place. The truth was that I did not know. Was this a move by the gods in their great game? No one could know such things with certainty, but I know what I sensed outside the ship.
"It is us," I sent back. "As we push, the storm pushes back. We push harder, it answers with thunder and acid and pain. Stop the ship! Stop the fleet!"
Abaddon released me and turned to the Oculus once more. Fury, absolute in its intensity, blackened his features.
"The fleet!"
Ultio began, and she needed to say no more. The Oculus finished her thought, showing the shapes of our armada shrinking, falling behind, several more shaking beyond tolerance and beginning to shatter, others engulfed with wrapping shrouds of warp energy. The vengeful spirit gave its most savage heave yet, throwing half of the command crew to the deck. Several crew stations detonated through their links to suffering pressure points elsewhere aboard the ship.
"The Blood Knight!"
Ultio called out, and her voice became a messy merging of warship names as they fell out of formation in grotesque and swift disorder.
"The White Citrus, the Hammer of Sarthas, the Halo Blades, the—"
Abaddon screamed. It was a wordless cry of raw emotion, the roar of a thwarted king without the power to protect his crumbling kingdom. Rage laced that cry, as one would surely expect, but there was also frustration. Frustration that others could not provide what he needed of them, and vexation that his plans were being swept aside by the hands of pathetic, accursed gods at this latest of hours.
Oh, stop!
Every warrior and crew member not actively engaged in keeping the ship held together turned to him. Ashrakai was down on one knee now, teeth bared into an invisible gale, his skin lacerated with a thousand cuts that wept tiny trickles of blood.
I can't get us through,
he wheezed across the vox. His lungs sounded full of fluid, most likely blood. The warp was cutting him to pieces along with the ship.
Oh, stop!
Abaddon roared a second time.
Lord, I come.
Abaddon ignored him, his blazing gaze locked on the anamnesis in her suspension tank. His voice was inaudible over the crashing, shaking bridge. All I saw was his mouth moving.
Altio! Signal the fleet! All stop! All stop!
The protesting, failing ship was riven by new thunder as the engines banked and the retros bawled into life. The shaking, that heaving wrench of abused iron, slowly began to abate. I watched the Oculus's compound eye view of the ships in our armada as they slowed in our wake. The ravaging warp tides eased around them. It took time to slow down, for our thrusters to bring everything into balance and for the warp's angry tides to finally settle. A warship is never silent, nor even truly quiet. Plasma reactors, kilometers away, send their living murmurs through every inch of metal. Crews speak, curse, breathe, shift. Power armor hums as it idles and snarls when its wearers move. The vengeful spirit's command deck was louder than most, with the size of its crew and the anamnesis's life support tank with all its ticking, clicking, ancillary cognition machines. The fleet clustered around us, drawing in close, the way a pack of beasts approaches its alpha, with their throats showing in submission. Abaddon watched them drifting into formation, saying nothing. I could sense the swift cycle of his thoughts, but could discern none of their meaning.
All stop,
Altio called after what felt like an age. I looked across the bridge at the wounded and the dead, at the smoky aftermath of our failure. We had failed. We were trapped. Ashrakai descended from his platform, boots thudding on the gantry stairs, and knelt before Abaddon. He looked destroyed by his futile efforts, his eyes closed, blood scabbing across the host of psi stigmata lacerations that covered his face and throat.
I tried, Ashrakai.
Blood spattered to the deck by Abaddon's boots, spilled from Ashakai's cut tongue. The warp had wounded him even there.
I tried.
There had been times before this, and there would be more to come, when Abaddon punished failure by execution. Sometimes, I must admit, these acts were delivered out of unrestrained anger, but more often as acts of calculated and precise mercilessness. To set examples, to establish boundaries, to spread fear, as all tyrants and warlords and kings have done, since time began and the first men and women ruled their brothers and sisters. But he is not without forgiveness. He knows when a defeat was unavoidable. That distant day, as our armada sat becalmed in the seas of madness, he barely even looked down at Ashrakai before resting a hand on the other warrior's pauldron and lifting the sorcerer to his feet.
You cannot fight fate, brother. But you did well to try.
That choice of words rekindled life in the sorcerer's red eyes. Shame, yes, but life as well. Something dangerously close to hope.
Is that what you believe this was?
He asked Abaddon.
Fate?
It was Mariana, an insignificant wraith at Abaddon's side, who drew my eye. I felt my irritation rise with the way she stood in Abaddon's shadow, where she alone seemed unbroken. Defeat settled across the rest of us like a cloak. Ashrakai and the anamnesis were riven by warp stigmata, and bodies of mutants lay across the bridge, yet she was the lone soul showing no unease at our continued imprisonment. She looked almost vindicated, as if this outcome had been a suspicion of hers since we brought her aboard all those weeks before, and here it finally stood confirmed.
Greatness requires sacrifice.
She looked between those of us gathered there, one by one, until her gaze finally settled on Ashokai.
It always requires sacrifice. It is the way of all life. I tried to tell you this, Ezekiel.
He shrugged her off, evidently not as enthralled to her words as we had feared. She drew breath to press her point.
When the time comes, you cannot run from what must be done. Sacrifices must always be made.
Be silent, he warned her. Look around you, prophetess. See the fraying tempers and defeated hearts of those nearby. Now is not the time to weave smug and mystical allusions to the preciousness of hindsight.
Telemachon laughed softly behind his mask, though more in derision at my annoyance than agreement with it. The Heor gave Moriana a disgusted glance before jerking his chin towards Abaddon.
So now what? He asked.
The question hung in the air between us. No one had an answer. In the long-ago Age of Sail, when vessels of wood and cloth rode the oceans of terror at the mercy of weather and wind, there were fewer fates worse than being becalmed. Vessels without the breath of wind in their sails were doomed to drift in the ocean, too far from land for oars to be any salvation. That is the situation we found ourselves in. We were becalmed. To go forwards was to die, while to go back was to abandon all hope of a future. If we could not revenge ourselves upon the Imperium, why then did we band together in this new brotherhood? Why did we still draw breath? Perhaps you think us stubborn. Perhaps you believe we should have turned away and sailed back from whence we came, back to those demon-world fortresses and those savage blood raids against our brethren. Perhaps it truly seems that simple to you. But then it would. You have never been free. Freedom, once tasted, cannot be so easily forgotten. Life in the Eye was an existence of hellish, endless battle in the underworld. It has always been our prison and our crucible, as much as our sanctuary. Yet there we sat, motionless in the warp-touched void. There, on the very edge of the Eye, we took stock of our losses. 7 warships lost with all hands. 5 times that number damaged, some grievously. 1,000s of legionaries gone, to say nothing of the mortal and mutant crews, or the priceless arsenals of war gear, gunships and battle tanks also fallen away into oblivion. In that long-ago era, before we had conceived of the Crimson Path, before Abaddon wearied of Cadia and wiped it from existence like excrement from his boot, the only reliable route out of the Great Eye was the so-called Cadian Gate. There, reality cut a deep gouge into eye space and soothed the seething tides. Yet a route out of the Eye is useless if it cannot even be reached in the first place. The worst aspect was that none of us had an answer to Lahiel's question. None of us knew what we could do to free the fleet from this etheric stalemate. The answer, when it came, was delivered in the form of destruction. I sensed nothing of the first asteroid. It was too swift for our storm-compromised Auspex scanners to track. We only became aware of it when the troop barge Scarred Crown blared warning cries across the fleet-wide VoxWeb, and by then it was already too late to do anything. The Scarred Crown was already dying, its diminished wreckage rolling and tumbling through space. The asteroid that had slain it had shattered in the impact. I watched a spread of huge rocks, each one streaming fire like a comet's tail, scattering into the misty void of ice space. Ultio closed her eyes, pressing a hand to her temple.
I...
She got no further. Another asteroid speared through the fleet, this time killing the Oath of Knives with a heart strike, bursting the cruiser's void shields and driving through its core, triggering a terminal unleashing of plasma that instantly annihilated the entire superstructure. Ultio turned in her blood-streaked fluid tank, hands tensing once more into claws.
"Translation signatures,"
she called out, and then, with her eyes widening,
"Brace! Brace!"
The engines fired, the ship's manoeuvring thrusters igniting along its starboard side. Every single soul aboard the vengeful spirit was thrown to the deck as the ship moved from all stop into a hard banking rolling turn, the vessel protesting at the pressures put upon its hull. The third asteroid still hit us. All power failed in the wake of that world-shaking crash. It took several seconds to reactivate, during which time we existed in a shaking, thrashing realm of absolute blackness. When the illumination globes flared back to life, they cast their light over Ultio in her suspension chamber, sigh stigmatic bruises blackening the flesh of her back and shoulders. Blood trailed from her left eye, threading into the amniotic fluid.
"Relighting voids,"
she mouthed, as her gargoyles declared the words aloud. The ship stabilized, slowing in its roll.
"Relighting voids. Seeking. Seeking."
On the Oculus, views of iSpace clicked through magnification filters as the anamnesis followed the asteroids' trajectories back to their origins. At first, I thought we were witnessing our Armada's shadow cast across the swirling mists of iSpace. I realized my error when I saw the vessels moving, and more warships penetrating the haze following behind them.
"Shield failure,"
Ultio called out.
"I am unable to rekindle the voids."
Abaddon watched from his central dais, eyes gleaming with vicious captivation.
"Ultio, signal the fleet to form a defensive sphere. All warships are to protect the supply runners and troop barges. Run out the guns. All hands prepare for battle."
"Another projectile,"
she warned.
"Destroy it."
She tried, but she was wounded from the storm, and too few of the vengeful spirit's weapons were ready to fire. No matter how swiftly her gestalt mind operated, the calculations for void battle at such insane ranges required time and precision. We had the luxury of neither. Torpedoes sluiced from their chambers, silently cutting the misty darkness of space. Several impacted on the surface of the inbound hunk of planetary rock, but most went wide, running harmlessly onwards. The frigate Skies of Wrath was already moving, rolling aside from the path of its oncoming doom. The asteroid hurtled past, illuminating the ship's voids as it came within sparking distance of the vessel's belly. Around me, the command deck had broken into a miasma of activity. Crews shouted and raced between stations. Legionaries demanded answers. Machinery thrummed and clanked. But I was watching the Oculus, ignoring the jostles I received from standing in the way. I watched the last asteroid spinning away into space after missing the Skies of Wrath. They were more than mere dead rock. They echoed with familiar whispers, familiar cries, as though the asteroids were alive, or had once been. The other fleet approached from the storm, sailing far calmer tides than those we had endured. Whatever forces had oppressed us offered no such resistance to these newcomers. They lingered at the very edge of our firing solutions, at a distance not only invisible to the naked eye, but requiring intensive calculation to even lock weapons. Only their weaponized meteors could reach us. More of them streamed through our spreading formations, but with our ships moving, there was no chance of striking at such a range with unguided projectiles. Only our own complacency and poor luck had allowed the deaths of the Scarred Crown and Oath of Knives. One of the lead battleships ignited with a procession of successive lights along its backbone. Not damage, but a harnessing and release of energy. Another meteor burst forth from beneath the vessel's hull.
"They're using mass drivers," I said.
Iliaster, pale and parched as ever, stared at the Oculus with his sunken gaze. Wearing our legion's black only highlighted his emaciation and cadaverous pallor. He spared me a roomy, unhealthy glance that still blazed with life.
"But why?"
he asked. I had no idea. "They're not even aiming," I replied. The next asteroid speared past us, parting the misty matter of ice space. I felt it again, that murmur of familiar voices. Ceraxia stalked closer to me, her bladed legs clank, clank, clanking on the deck. The dim light of battle stations cast her hooded features into absolute blackness. All I could see of her face was the faintest glint off the edge of one eye lens.
"You sense something?"
she accused me. "Those asteroids. They sound like... they feel like... like Malium." The same whispers I had heard on that dead world, the same choruses of ghosts. "Blood of the gods," I swore, turning and ascending Abaddon's dais. He was watching another fusillade of vast rocks slash past us. "Ezekiel, those asteroids, their mass drivers won't hit us at this range. Not now we're ready for them." I waved his reassurance aside. "Those aren't just void rocks. They've shattered the grave world. They're throwing Malium at us." Abaddon spat a curse.
"Tagus Daravik."
I could only agree. Leaving our dominion behind had meant sailing far from the reach of our astropathic relays and telemetry beacons. The forces we had left to garrison our territory were pulled tight to the most critical regions, with skeleton fleets and war hosts around our primary fortresses, leaving the rest of our domain at the risk of invasion. We knew this was a risk. We accepted it as necessary. And thus, we had no conception of what was transpiring in our absence. For all of our suspicions that Daravik might pursue us, we had no way of knowing what form that pursuit would take. Now we did. Daravik had leveled Malium from orbit and was hurling the planet's bones after us.
"As insults go," Abaddon admitted through clenched teeth, "I almost admire the bastard."
He called up to the Amamnesis in her containment chamber.
"Altio, can we kill that fleet?"
She had already processed a multitude of estimates and probabilities.
"Yes," she replied, watching the motionless armada that faced us. "Casualties will be catastrophic on both sides, but yes, we can kill them."
Abaddon stared at the oculus, the same calculations firing behind his narrowed eyes.
"Daravik can't intend to fight here."
He spoke of the storm's instability around us, but also, I suspect, the fact that our fleets were so evenly matched. Forcing the issue here would be definitive, but practically suicidal.
"They have nothing that can match the spirit,"
Telemachon urged, as he appeared at Abaddon's side.
"We should fight."
"And if they cripple half of our fleet while we're beating them?" I countered. "You ate that Templar's brain the same as I did. You know what lies beyond the Eye's borders. We cannot afford to limp our way out of here with the real battle yet to come." The decision was stolen from us when the Anamnesis laughed, the sound resonating in tinny majesty from her damaged vox gargoyles. She twisted in her blood-streaked fluid, her laughter bitter and dark. A moment later, voices rose from the crew consoles responsible for the vox array.
"They are hailing us!"
Altio called out over one of the human officers, saying the same thing.
"Daravik wishes to meet on neutral ground."
Abaddon added his laughter to the tempest of amusement already taking hold of the bridge.
"On what terms does he offer for this truce?"
The communications officer in his tattered finery replied, still holding one hand to his earpiece.
"You and him, Lord Abaddon, each may bring 10 warriors. You may choose the neutral ground upon which to meet."
Ezekiel was still chuckling.
"Tell him I do not need 10 warriors. Inform him that I will bring 3.
"Yes, Lord Abaddon."
Abaddon turned amused eyes back to me.
"Is something amiss, Kaon?"
3 warriors, I asked. My disapproving tone spoke for me.
"I am Lord of the Black Legion," he said.
And it was the first time I ever heard him speak those words, naming us as our enemies named us.
"No one dictates terms to me. Let the coward bring his 10 for protection. I will bring 3, and we will smile throughout his tawdry truce."
He bared his filed teeth in the ugliest of grins.
And if the chance arises, Kaon, I want you to kill him.
Chapter 9. A Garden of Bones. There were no worlds nearby to use as neutral ground, at least none that we could reach from where we were becalmed in the heart of the storm. It was Nefertari who gifted us with an idea. She came to us with Ashikai at her side. They approached the rest of the Ezakarian as we stood around the stellar cartography hololith, presenting its unreliable imagery of the flux of nearby ice space. Ashikai spoke first, his voice softer since he had sustained the host of psychic stigmata wounds that had healed scabbily across his features. From his discomforted movements and the ripples of pain radiating from his thoughts, he was wounded within his armour, not just on his face. Injuries of psi stigmata and war affliction are wounds to the soul as much as to the mind and body. They are notoriously agonizing, enough to drive unaugmented humans far beyond reason. Worse still, I suspected that the lacerations to his flesh were mirrored on his muscles and internal organs. He was fortunate to still be alive.
"The alien,"
he said with his typical distant politeness,
"has an idea."
"Tiasha,"
she said. And she gestured at the hololith, to a patch of shifting ice space devoid of planet or moon or sun.
"Well, tell Sherry," Lahior grunted.
He had never deemed it necessary to learn any of the Eldar tongues.
"There's nothing there."
"Tiel Shara,"
Telemachon corrected him, murmuring with no small reverence. Nefertari closed her eyes for a moment, an Eldar gesture of agreement and trust at Telemachon's perfect pronunciation.
"It was slain in the Exodus, begun with the birth of She Who Thirsts,"
the Eldar continued.
"You need somewhere to meet your foes, There lies Craft World Tiel Shara, its bones cold in the tainted night. Use its grave for your neutral ground."
Abaddon spoke through a fanged smile. The idea seemed to appeal to him.
"Can we reach it, Ashikai?"
"I believe so, Lord."
And so it was decided. Abaddon was true to his word, taking only three warriors, arguably the three most calculated to challenge Daravek's temper. We arrived first at Abaddon's choice. Around us rose the shattered arches and broken domes of wraithbone architecture, absent of the usual psychic thrumming that teased the senses in the presence of the alien material. As Nefertari had promised, Tiel Shara was dead. Even demons left it alone. Every shred of nourishment had been sucked clean from its husk, down to the plaintive whispers of its ghosts. All was cold. All was silent. Have you ever walked through the deep void palaces and spires of an Eldar craft world? They defy easy imagining. Each craft world is an artificial city, born through alien ingenuity and pushed out to sail the dark heavens like a life raft. They are constructed of psychically resonant wraithbone and shielded against the touch of space. Domes are given over to habitation, others to inhuman hydroponics and agricultural cultivation, others to the Eldar's many temples of war. Every craft world is home to a different Eldar culture, each realm its own unique jewel in the night. Tiel Shara, like so many others, did not escape the death of the species in time. As it fled the birth of the youngest god, it was torn open and swept clean of life, trapped forever within the grip of the Great Eye. After securing the landing area, we gathered together to wait in the shadow of our gunship. Its black hull showed the golden eye of Horus set in the heart of the Eightfold Path, a reminder of our origins in rebellion, set now amidst the pathways of the future. Abaddon came to me as I crouched by the edge of what had once been a reflecting pool, doubtless where the Eldar of this botanical garden once meditated. I tossed a broken chunk of wraithbone into the dry, empty pond, where only the ashes of plants remained. The hank of curved bone disturbed a smoky cloud of grey powder.
brother?
He asked me. His good mood was holding. If there is one thing Ezekiel has always loved, it is a challenge. He lives to test himself against worthy foes. All is well, I assured him, rising to my feet. I cast my gaze across the shattered dome's landscape. If I let my senses drift and my eyes unfocus, I could see wraithly after-images of the alien jungle realm that had once thrived here. I was merely thinking.
Thinking of what?
I gestured to the Wraithbone ruins. This place, the serenity here, the silence, it tempts me.
I'll never understand your fascination with the Eldar,
he said, thudding a hand against my back-mounted power pack in fraternal warmth. Well, there is no mystery to it, I said sincerely. They are a warning of what happens when the Pantheon controls a species, as opposed to a species showing caution in its dealings with the divine. Little did I know as I spoke those words just how familiar Tial Shara would become to me in time. I was preaching to the choir, of course. His smile told me that. Daravek and his cohort arrived in the fat-bellied mass of a Sikri-pattern Stormbird gunship, eclipsing our sleeker Thunderhawk. Death Guard symbols marked its scored hull, and its turrets tracked us in a display of tedious, unnecessary aggression. We remained still, and if unsurprised disappointment at needless posturing could be weaponized, I believe Abaddon's sigh would have slaughtered the Stormbird there and then, dragging it out of the air. He alone seemed at ease. Iliaster and Telemachon, as dispassionate as they could be, betrayed their tension in their stances. For my part, I could not look away from the descending gunship, feeling the dread gaze of its cannons, suspecting Daravek would simply end the truce by taking this chance to eradicate us. I could shield us with a barrier of telekinetic force, but a kind shield would avail us little if the craft world crumbled around us. The Stormbird's landing claws crunched onto the Wraithbone platform. The gang ramp slammed down, disgorging the 11 warriors we had been expecting. They came in a clash of colours. Every one of the 9 legions was represented, even the Sons of Horus. I sensed Abaddon's amusement sour to annoyance at the sight of that warrior, though he let nothing show on his face. The bitterness was fleeting. It seemed little could dampen his mood of righteous confidence. Daravek led them. Each was a warlord in his own right, but Tagus Daravek held their allegiance, either by willing oath or the servitude of thraldom. He strode forwards, boots sending cracks through the Wraithbone floor. The gods hate us all, I've told you this, but they craved Tagus Daravek's attention. The warp murmured in the air around him, ripe with the spirits of disease and creatures of mutable fate, all of them chittering promises of golden futures and life eternal into their master's aura. He furled his wings tight to his body. Those mutated pinions were surely too weak to lift him skywards in all his rot-crusted Terminator regalia. The metallic spines that thrust from his skin and bone alike were sheened with blood as thick and dark as unrefined promethium oil. He stood opposite Abaddon, the two of them 10 meters apart. On the ground between the warlords was a shattered pictograph of coloured glass, its original artistry long since destroyed, its meaning long since lost. I confess there was something kingly about Daravek that day. Abaddon looked as he always looked, a lord of war, a leader of men, a war chief. He was one of us, and first among equals. Daravek was something more, something that held itself above the warriors he led. In the eye, where thoughts become reality, one could almost see the chains of submission from the legionaries' throats bound to Daravek's clawed hands. I wondered what hold he had over their souls, whether it was a lord's mastery or something deeper.
First Captain Abaddon of the Sons of Horus,
Daravek greeted my brother. Abaddon replied with a warm, sincere laugh at his rival's choice of words.
Tagus Daravek, Lord of Hosts, we meet at last.
It is a change, Daravek allowed, to face you rather than your useless assassin.
You would have faced me long before now if you would cease fleeing before my armies each time I come to kill you.
Daravek made a show of his bleeding gums, which may or may not have been a smile.
I see Kaon at your side now, making this our seventh meeting. Is that not so, Iskandar?
Sixth, I corrected him. He gurgled his amusement.
No, assassin. It is the seventh, and the masked prince is here as well. I am honored, Telemachon Lyras.
Telemachon inclined his head in respectful bow, but said nothing. Daravek turned to the last of our ambassadorial party.
And of course I recognize my beloved brother Iliester.
He had been too canny to let anger discolour his voice so far, but poison seeped into his tone as he faced Iliester.
How do you fare, traitor?
The former Death Guard performed a shallower bow than Telemachon, the joints of his blackened warplate snarling.
I am well,
he said with a gaunt and vague smile.
Thank you for asking. Forgive me, but I did not bring your ceremonial scythe, Lord. It was melted down to make piss-pots for my slaves.
To my shame, I had to force myself not to show any amusement, for I knew this to be true. Daravek licked his decaying teeth.
You did not deserve to wear the haloed skull, Iliester. I hope you wept as you tore the symbols of your true legion from your armor.
From shame and shadow recast,
Iliester said, rekindling Abaddon's smile.
In black and gold reborn.
Daravek snorted.
Let me introduce my warriors,
he said with undeniable condescension. He swept his hand across the gathered legionaries, but Abaddon interrupted him with a grinding scrape of the Talon's claws closing and opening.
There's no need, Abaddon replied, for I do not care what names your slaves bear. You wish to meet and speak, Daravek. We have met. Now speak.
The Death Guard Lord bristled, and one of his warriors stepped forwards, breaking their uneven ranks. He wore the mismatching green, black, and red of the Sons of Horus Reaver clans.
I am no slave,
he spat to Abaddon.
I wear my legion's colours with pride, renegade.
Abaddon's eyes never left Daravek.
One of your dogs is whining, Tagus. I thought you had a better leash on their behaviour.
Daravek ordered the warrior back into the ranks with a curt gesture. The Sons of Horus legionary reluctantly obeyed.
Do you wish to observe the formalities before we negotiate?
Tagus asked. He spoke of the traditional duel between champions that many warbands enjoyed before a battle, or before attempts at diplomacy. When warriors gather, there will always be such contests. Reputation is everything to us. In the Nine Legions, there is no more valuable currency than renown. When I sailed alone, I usually allowed Nefertari to do the honours. A great many mutants and warriors had fallen to her alien blades. I had expected Abaddon to laugh at the idea, but he nodded once, his lip curling.
By all means. Who will step forwards from the gathering of heroes that cower in your shadow?
Daravek's champion stepped forwards at once. I knew him. Ulrek Ansontin was one of the Lord of Hosts' more renowned warband leaders, and even before the rebellion against the Emperor, he was known as a gifted bladesman in the Fourth Legion. The light of the choked stars glinted from his filthy ceramite, as though proximity to Daravek had allowed the warlord's gods-given blessings to spread. His visor was a slit of red, gleaming from within. Ulrek drew a plain, durable power sword, the same metallic hue as his armor plating. He saluted Telemachon with a sweep of the blade, and his voice emerged through the portcullis faceplate of his crested Mark III helm.
Long have I wished to face the masked prince.
The other warriors murmured amongst themselves. This promised to be a duel for the ages. Even Iliaster's yellowed eyes were lit with a fever that spoke of dark excitement. Telemachon stepped forwards, as was expected of Abaddon's champion. No deadlier fighter existed within the Black Legion. He was already drawing his blades when Abaddon lifted the talon, halting his advance.
I have no need to waste my finest warrior's time, he said with vicious reasonableness. Telemachon, stay back, please. Kaon?
I believe I actually blinked in surprise.
My brother?
Abaddon aimed the talon at the towering form of Ulrich and Sontin.
Kill him.
I hesitated, and that triggered guttural laughter from the warriors opposing us. Telemachon murmured beneath his breath some unknown sound of displeasure. He wanted this fight. I was inclined to let him take it, that my lord had spoken.
As you wish,
I replied, with far more confidence than I felt.
No sorcery, Daravek called out with a bladed grin. This is a matter for swords to settle.
Abaddon gave a lazy gesture of agreement, and in doing so, I was sure he had killed me. I stepped forwards, drawing sacramentum, letting its silver length turn violet beneath the storm's tainted light. When I returned Ulrich's salute, he remained silent. Daravek spoke as the two of us drew close.
And Sontin has killed 31 warriors in single combat. How many have you slain in these duels, assassin?
3, I replied. This caused fresh laughter from the ranks at Daravek's side. Ulrich held his blade at the ready. The claws of unformed demons caressed across his armor plating, where brass icons of skulled faces stared cold and eyeless. Spirits of pain ringed his own skull in a crown of bleak light. His voice was a peal of thunder.
I dedicate your death to the god of blood and battle.
I thought he might say that. He did not wait to see if I had a similar benediction. He attacked at once, his sword flaring to life and cutting the air with the waspish buzz of its power field. Sacramentum snapped to life with a much smoother purr, a testament to the artisanship of its creation. Most champions, like Nefertari and Telemachon, are consummately talented in single combat. They are duelists, as much as warriors, often more so, devoting their lives and souls to the pursuit of perfection in the art of fighting a single foe. I had expected the first exchanges of my duel with Ulrich to follow the same pattern, focusing on learning, not immediately seeking to kill. We would trade blows, study the positioning of one another's bodies, ascertain what schools of blade work we preferred, and measure the flow and feel of the fight. This was how most duels began, where expertise and skill mattered far more than in the grinding crash of war. Though some duelists may not admit it, it also allows the muscles to warm, the blood to flow, and the adrenal narcotics in our armor systems to flood through, buying time for a combatant to immerse himself in the fight. Ulrich had other ideas. He considered himself far above me in terms of swordsmanship, or else believed he could kill me while his blood was still cold, for he advanced at once, laying into me with a succession of blows that I barely blocked with the flat of my priceless sword. I gave ground with each parry. Several of Daravek's warriors shouted their approval to see me on the defensive already. They suspected a swift end to the fight. The Thousand Sons were never renowned as the most martial of legions, and it was often said we relied too heavily on our psychic gifts to win wars. There was perhaps some truth to this accusation, but we were individually no less skillful than our cousins among the other legions, even before taking into account the years of blood and battle since Horus's rebellion. Where many warriors fought through instinct and rote, we added a scholarly approach to dueling, with mental techniques of focus in tune with the meditative Kata found among the more philosophical martial arts. The principles of balance, of action and reaction, of how to lead an opponent into revealing the flaws of their technique and how to avoid their lures in kind, all of these aspects of battle were drilled into our consciousnesses in the years of our training on Tisca and the warfare that followed. Against our more savage or rigorously trained kindred, such personal discipline evened the odds. So I was calm in the face of Ulrich's overwhelming force, at least outwardly. Such was the power and speed of his blows that I struggled to maintain my battle focus. I imagined Telemachon watching, disgusted with my performance. I imagined Abaddon's eyes on me, unblinking in their judgment. I was no longer unsure of his motives, certain, instead, that he had committed me to this fight in order to see me die. The rewards of my failures reaped at last. And how apt that it would be before Daravek himself, and brought about by the Lord of Hosts' own champion. Ulrich drew first blood, He took advantage of a poor deflection to risk a cut to my torso, carving a slashing ravine across my breastplate. The cheers from his brethren redoubled.
Focus,
I warned myself. Our blades met, locked close to the hilts. We were close enough for me to see the reflection of my black battle plate in the filthy